You know, I have a bunch of friends that say my shoes are ugly, but screw it. These are awesome shoes and I'm going to wear them.
Hey everybody, and welcome to Across the Table. I'm your host, Matt Mendoza, and this is the 28th episode in my interview with writer and coverage guy, Adam Staborski. We tried to meet up in D.C., but due to a faulty XLR cable, we were not able to record. Fortunately for you, however, we met up via Skype and recorded this interview. And I apologize for the week off. I occasionally just need a week to breathe. Work has been kind of crazy. Oh, and there was that D.C. trip I talked about. Anyway. Oh, and one thing before I forget. The internet, while I was recording this interview, was kind of spotty, so I apologize for any choppy bits. Well, then thank you very much, and enjoy the interview. So, Adam, what did you have for lunch today?
I had Chipotle, paid for by a vendor, so it was extra delicious.
Oh, vendor? Where at?
At work. They came in, and we had like a 2.5-hour meeting, and they bought lunch.
Nice.
It's kind of how it works. They brought in coffee, got us jacked up on caffeine, talked to us for 2.5 hours, fed us lunch, and shoved us out. It was awesome.
Doesn't sound too bad. Is it a typical day at the office?
Actually, more or less, yeah. Marketing is sweet.
Sweet. All right, I am here with Adam Staborski. And Adam, what do you do?
Well, I'm a database marketing analyst at Geico. So it's kind of like my formal job, what brings home the bacon, so to say. But I'm also content manager for Gathering Magic.
Okay.
Kind of oversee and coordinate all the content that comes in and goes through the site. I'm a weekly writer for Daily MTG, the Command Tower column on Thursdays. So I focus on Commander and all the sweet cards that go with it. And I also do event coverage for Daily MTG. So I'll go to a Grand Prix. I've done a Pro Tour. Just cover the events, write up feature matches, do interviews. Metagame recaps has kind of been my shtick the past couple Grand Prix, but basically just cover the event and try to describe the story. You know, if you're not there, you don't watch the live coverage or it's not available, you can kind of understand what's going on.
Now, a lot of people know who you are. A lot of people don't know how much work that you actually do. How do you do it?
I don't sleep a lot. I mean, that's part of it. Like today's a great example. So, I needed to hit my contracting deadline for Daily MTG, so I was up until 1 a.m. doing some reformatting, kind of moving things around. I cut a bunch of stuff that I didn't like, which left me feeling like the article was a little short. And then I got up at 5:30 a.m. to do a little last minute editing. It's a little gross, but it's fine. Did some last minute editing, did some adjustments, double checked that I had all the cards in the deck lists that were provided, went into work, shipped it off from my phone, kind of in a break at work, because that's something I can do from my phone. It's great. Dropbox and Mailbox, they work together. It's great. And then I spent, I was at work from 6:30 until 5 p.m., which is an hour and a half earlier than I thought I would be. So I come home, spend a little time with my daughter and my wife, and she's kind enough to make dinner most nights, so I was able to eat. And then I came downstairs, went through and queued, did all the WordPress backend final touches for Gathering Magic content. And I was actually just started to write up kind of the social media blurbs and things that get scheduled for sharing all that content throughout the day to do a podcast right now. That's been my day so far. When we're done with the podcast, I'll go ahead and finish those posts. We don't use a scheduling system on Gathering Magic, because we have a bunch of kind of cool macros and some things that are in place that make it difficult to automate using WordPress automation. Okay. So we push the button live at midnight. It's a human process. So that'll happen. And then I'll gear everything up, tweet that the articles are live for the night, and then hopefully get 5 restful hours of sleep. Start over.
Now, is that your typical day?
Yeah. Yeah, that's like a typical weekday. Weekends are a little loosey-goosey, because that's when Grand Prix and traveling usually happens. So if there's a Grand Prix, I'll leave work. I'll do everything I normally do. We have an excellent associate editor, Gathering Magic, Carlos Gutierrez, a really awesome guy. He's doing some grad school work, and he does some tutoring and some part-time work. And so he kind of helps balance load. So I will, if I travel, so like Friday night, Saturday night, Carlos handles queuing and posting our weekend content. I'll leave straight from work to catch a flight to the Grand Prix, put in 2 16-hour days, and then catch a flight at like 6 in the morning, the earliest direct flight I can get back out home, and then drive straight into work Monday. So it's a modified schedule, but it just means I sleep a little bit less.
Oh, okay. That's fun.
Yeah, I just kind of like shave a few hours off. If I'm lucky, like the flight's like a good hour and a half, so I can fall asleep before takeoff and wake up like when they're dinging to put the tray tables up for landing. That's like the ideal scenario, but it doesn't always happen.
Oh, man. That's one way to live the life, I guess.
I'm young. This is not a forever, like, I don't mean to make it sound like glamorous or dramatic or I'm some sort of superhuman. I'm just young. Like,
glamorous.
I've gotten more tired, I've noticed, over time. Like, this is not like, I pull all-nighters in college. Like, numerous times I would, I've got a BA in mathematics. So, like, every numerous times I'm working on, like, a problem set packet, work straight through the night, turn it in at 8 a.m. the next morning. I don't do that really anymore. Like, pulling an all-nighter just wrecks me for, like, a good week because I can't recover.
Well, yeah, when you rely on those 5 glorious hours of sleep every night. No, Adam, so that's your week. Where did this all start? Let's take me back to where are you from?
You mean like my mother's womb from, or are you talking sure. like magic from?
Where like where were you born?
I was born like up in northwest Pennsylvania. I have some family up towards Lake Erie, the Erie, Cambridge Springs area. I guess I moved down with my family when I was kind of young, to York, Pennsylvania, so South Central PA, north of Baltimore, not that far from where I'm at now in DC, but that's pretty much where I grew up. This is one house across from a farm, but in a suburb. I don't know how that's possible, but the
a farm in a suburb.
Yeah, it's just very strange. It's just a farm across the road, but we're like, it's like suburban York. Kind of got into magic in middle school, of course, like a lot of kids. It was later 90s. This is like 95, 96, something like that. Ice Age Mirage were all the cards that I remember.
Okay.
I don't remember the dates, but I remember Keljorn Undead was like the coolest card ever because it was a 3/1 that regenerated. Like, it just didn't die. Nothing killed it. Giant Mantis was the worst because it could block all the flyers. 2/4 reach? That's impossible.
Yeah. So. Giant but, Spider.
No, Giant Mantis. That was the Giant Spider in Mirage.
But Giant Spider was around then, right?
I think so, but it was Woolly Giant Spider? Mantis is what I remember.
Okay.
Yeah, it was an insect, I think. Or Mantis. No, it was a Mantis, and it was later ratted to an insect, maybe. I don't know. I have to look it up. But just kind of played casually with like friends in school. Went to college up in northern Pennsylvania, kind of. Got out of Magic a little bit. I got back into it when I found out apparently it was still a thing. A lot of people played. So this was Betrayers and Ravnica era. So like, I was just like hooked, like seeing new dual lands for the first time. Like that was like the first Magic the Gathering article I remember reading was I just got linked to this. I saw this link on, I think it was MySpace. I don't know. One of the early social media things. It might even been an IRC where I was chatting with people, and it was just like it blew my mind.
Oh, like the original, like the original Shocklands.
Yeah, yeah, because okay. It was Temple Garden, and they had it was like full page just appeared, and it was just like, it was just like, whoa, like this is like insane. Like
they were
this
really exciting,
way too good. Yeah. Now everybody's like, ooh, boring. These lands that let me filter and set up my next draw, oh, they're awful. Go to hell.
Now, when you started, that caught you the second time. What caught you about Magic the first time?
It was just playing with friends. Like, it still is that way. Like, that's why I play. Like, it's never really that competitive. I never, I'm definitely not like the FNM type, let alone really anything higher. But just like sitting around with like friends and chewing the fat and playing like an ugly multiplayer game where we're just hanging out for a couple hours. Like, that's just kind of like, that's what I remember. And every time I do like sealed and I do some sort of like multiplayer sealed format or multiplayer draft format, like that's what it feels like. It's just I'm sitting down and talking with people and we're having fun and wild things are happening. We're not always quite sure what the rules are when something's strange, but it's enjoyable and it's a lot of fun.
And how did you discover it? Like through your friends? Like were you in school or?
Yeah, my one buddy just had the cards. And so he was like, I learned this game, Magic. I'm like, okay, like magic tricks? Like, I didn't know. But yeah, he just like brought like a box and it was like, it seemed like infinite cards. And it was like 200 or something. We're talking like a couple starter decks. And yeah, just like we would build decks out of it. And eventually he was like, I'm done with Magic and gave me like his little pool of cards. And it's just kind of stuck with me since.
What was it about it?
Some of it was fantasy and escapism. Like I was always big on the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, like C.S. Lewis series. I loved Tolkien and the Lord of the Rings series. The Hobbit kind of got me hooked. Read that early. R.A. Salvatore's series, starting with like the Crystal Shard and the whole adventures, Drisdor Durden. Just always loved like the fantasy genre. And so like the idea that there was like this cool card game that was kind of like strategic and like it made me think about stuff, but I was like casting spells and I was like a nigh omnipotent demigod. That was really kind of appealing to a 13-year-old. Like that seemed really sweet. Like, wow, I can get behind this guy. Like I get to do whatever the heck I want and like cast all these spells and summon monsters and it was the fantasy tropes definitely like drew me in and then I kind of got into the story because like Wrath Tempest was like the first big, the Weatherlight Saga was like the first big story. So like I remember like that was like the first sealed Magic product I bought was a Tempest starter. So it had the whole storybook. It wasn't a game manual. It didn't have the full rules. It said, warning, this does not tell you how to play. It just described like the new mechanics. And then it was a storybook. And it was the same size as the little tiny Ice Age rule book that I had. But it was just the story of these characters and
They
this
were those
are
books were really awesome.
yeah like so just like looking at the cards and seeing the story and trying to like piece together what was happening, like I just ate that up, and that was like the magic thing that hooked me. But without like having the friends to play with and like having that really cool gaming experience, like I definitely wouldn't have stuck with it. Like both together, it was just like like putting syrup on my hotcakes.
Yeah. No, you mentioned you were a fan of fantasy already. Where did that come from?
I don't know, I guess it's just kind of like the dorky, nerdy kind of kid growing up. Like, I loved reading, and I read a lot of books. Remember, I used to really enjoy, like, a book called Homer Price, and it was basically just a bunch of fantastical stories about this, like, small town. Of course, like, boy Homer Price is kind of, like, part of all of them. And I think I just kind of, like, got into, like, the whole fantasy, kind of, like, alternate reality, whatever you want to whatever it's called, I'm not quite sure, but I just kind of got into like reading these stories, like these amazing stories about other people and other characters, and it just kind of fell out from there. So like I would go home and like I would either play my Game Boy and play like Link's Awakening, or I'd be like re reading a book about some dude running around with a sword. And I think it was just like that was what was appealing.
Gotcha.
I was also big on Star Wars, so. We're not just talking, high fantasy. Sci-fi is cool too.
Sweet. No, I'm asking because I was made fun of when I was a kid, and a lot of my nerdy tendencies were escapism. Is that the same case with you, or
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, I
were you a
totally.
popular kid, or were you?
No.
Oh,
Definitely not. I mean, to be fair, I was kind of an asshole too. Like, I was
really?
definitely not like a nice guy all the time. I've kind of had to work at it, and I'm still not always a nice guy. Like, catch me on the wrong day at the wrong time. But I work at it and I recognize it. I look back and I'm like, if I just worked at it and recognized it, maybe it would have been different. But at
What
the
do you
same
mean, like
time,
you were
I
an
just
asshole? Like, especially as
I
a
mean,
kid.
it's just like a jerk. you know, like, just not very nice all the time. And, you know, it's definitely a little weird, and I kind of always walked to the beat of my own drum. It was kind of how I had it put to me in high school, and it was just like some people, you know, a handful of people really respected that. They're like, I just didn't care what other people thought all the time, which is, you know, at one side it's callous and kind of rubs people the wrong way, especially when they expect you to care about them, because that's what they really care about. So it kind of throws them for a loop, and of course, you know, that creates some backlash. But then other people kind of see that and they're like, well, you know, yeah, you're definitely not like awesome person, but like you also don't just like do what other people say either. Yeah, and that's just kind of like just how I was, you know, just kind of a little awkward, definitely paying attention to different stuff and not really looking at things the same way as kind of like my peers. Mm-hmm. Whether that's good or bad, or, you know, I'm not saying it's better, it's just I didn't look at it the same way. I didn't have the same experiences growing up. You know, my parents got divorced, my dad wasn't always very nice to me, so, you know, I had to learn a lot of things in different ways, and, you know, it kind of took some time for me to grow up.
What did you mentioned you learned a lot of things in different ways. Can you talk about something specific?
Yeah, I mean, like some of it's just mundane stuff. Like, I didn't grow up like with you know, like my dad, like you know, like if you're, you know, traditionally, let's put it that way, you know, if you're a boy and like you're working on your bike, like your dad is the one that already knows how bikes work and he kind of shows you what to do with it. That's not how I learned to work a bike. Like, it's not how I learned to like rechain my bike if the chain popped off. I had to learn from, you know, a neighbor friend who took the time to show me. You know, like, you know, it's just kind of like when and how I would learn different stuff, or like, you know, get models for social interaction. A lot of it came later. You know, like, I had a stepdad who kind of came along after a few years, and that was kind of where I actually saw good social interaction and kind of extroverted, you know, kind of social dialogue and outgoingness. And that's, you know, something that I didn't start picking up on until I was already, you know, almost out of high school. So, you know, when you're behind the curve, kind of learning some of those social things and trying to like, you know, normalize yourself, if you don't have good examples, you know, it takes time to catch up. And that's kind of what I mean. It's just, I didn't always necessarily learn it right away.
Uh-huh.
It came later.
Now, do you think that this, like, your nerdy proclivities, do you think that helped you or hurt you?
It might help
giving
me
you like in giving you like kind of a way to, I mean, giving you an escape in both good and bad ways.
I mean, that was some of it, but I mean, I also had a bunch of friends who loved Star Wars, and I was borrowing the R.A. Salvatore's books from my buddy who would always get the latest one. So I mean, it's not like I didn't have friends, and I was just kind of like, you know, like that kid sitting on a tire swing by himself for 12 hours, but summer. You know, but it was just, you know, it was just a little different. You know, I was at a smaller school, so like it wasn't like a massive, you know, it wasn't like I was kind of like hiding in like a sea of anonymity. Like, everybody knew each other, and we all ended up having to like talk to each other and stuff at you know, different points, you know. So it's not all bad. You know, I don't mean to exaggerate and say mm-hmm. it was like the worst experience ever, but, you know, for me, it was just like, I mean, that was just what I was interested in. I didn't really care that other people thought it was kind of different. It was cool. that's all I knew. Like, this feels great. This looks awesome. Yeah, I'm fine with this.
Cool. And then, so you played Magic for a while. And how was high school for you?
It's okay. Like, I didn't really do a lot of social stuff. Like, I got a job my freshman year.
Okay.
So I ended up working a lot of the weekends. I played tennis one season. It was a lot of fun. I did theater for 4 years, though. I did the fall. We always had a play in the fall, and I always did the play, and then they'd have a musical in the spring, and I would do the musical. So I got to be Mayor Shim and like Music Man. And our senior year, we did Barnum, which is kind of like the life of P.T. Barnum, the ringmaster circus entertainer.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really interesting, because I had I learned how to juggle, and I learned how to walk stilts. And so I learned how to juggle while walking 3-foot stilts, which is kind of like the coolest. Yeah, it's kind of like the coolest thing, you know. And it's like, you know, like,
do you still know how to do that?
I don't think I could do it anymore. but at the time, it was like, you know, it's like a cool thing, you know.
And then, so where did Magic kind of fit into all of this? Were you still playing at the time?
It kind of phased out, just between like working my job and a lot of the friends that I used to play with like had different interests, or that was kind of like the peak for like the Super Nintendo and like the PlayStation was, you know, just coming out. So I guess the Dreamcast wasn't that far along either. It was 1999. It was the middle of high school. So, you know, it's just different interests. Like I didn't throw away the cards, but I just wasn't like actively playing all the time. Like I kind of fell out of, like after Urza's Legacy, it just kind of like fell off.
Oh, but that was just such a fun time for Magic, right? a very degenerate time.
The death. Yeah, yeah. If you like degeneracy, it was excellent.
Yeah,
it was. And Counterspell days, Forbid. There was definitely a lot of really fun Magic happening. Let me tell you.
Theater. What kind of caught you about theater? Because it seems like for a kid like you, that was theater would be kind of an odd fit.
Not really. I mean, I wanted recognition and acceptance, you know, and
okay.
I was never like the quiet kid in the corner. I was always willing to voice my opinion and talk, and you know, my mom would tell me when I was like a toddler, I would just like walk up to like the old folks sit like resting in the bench in the mall. I would just like walk up and start talking to them, like completely, you know, completely fearless. So for me, it was just like, you know, I thought it was like a cool thing to do, and I wanted to get some recognition. Probably it was part of it, but it was just, you know, I was willing to put myself out there and just do lines, and also playing another character. I mean, that's definitely another form of escapism. Like,
yeah,
you know, when you really get into a character, you start to just like go through, you know, kind of like imagining what they feel like, and you start to feel that, you know, I guess the whole, if you're a good actor, you can cry on command litmus test. You know, I was never that good. But, you know, the idea is that you really just throw yourself into this character. And then that was something, you know, that was definitely appealing about theater. Is like when I was Mayor Shin, I was just like really loud and obnoxious and just totally, totally like the Mayor Shin character. And I could just do that. And it was great. It was fun.
No, I did theater as well. And in theater, you know, you get a lot of criticism. In good constructive criticism, so you become a better actor. Now, it seems like you being the asshole or the kid who walked to his own drum and stuff, did you ever have trouble accepting criticism? Or did you...
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, like, what teenager doesn't have some trouble, you know, accepting criticism? You know, like, I always thought I was a better singer than I was, and I'm a pretty, pretty damn awful singer. So, you know, that was always a challenge, and seeing other people that, you know, that I kind of grew up through high school always acting alongside, you know, getting like the lead role or like a really cool role that I wanted. And I always got like the, I guess my claim to fame was that I was always the best at projecting because I was never mic'd for any of the productions, which is good because like, that means I can push my voice out there, but it's also bad because when you watch the videos, I'm not on the audio track. So I just I'm just like super faint in the video. Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that I think everybody kind of has to face at some point. Like you just start to learn, like you've got to learn the hard way sometimes and you're just not as good about stuff. And it kind of took me a lot of hard learning to figure that out.
Now, did that extend into your early adulthood as well?
Oh yeah. between like when I entered college, I mean, I entered college and, you know, it seemed like a perfect opportunity. You know, there are a lot of people that I think wisely take the chance to reinvent themselves. Like when they walk on campus as a freshman, cause nobody knows who they are, where they're from. They can pretty much invent whatever, you know, persona or whatever front, or, you know, they can fake it until they make it, you know, that kind of principle.
Mm-hmm.
Me with my blithering and, my brutal honesty and just like just not caring enough to act like a different person. Yeah, I just kept on being the same person for a while.
Feel like that was a good or a bad decision in hindsight?
I don't know. I mean that's always one of those things where, like, if you could go back and change, would you change it? I'm like, I'm not sure, because like that helped make me this, you know, better person theoretically today. So I think I would have had a lot more fun a lot sooner if I had just started, applying some of the lessons I learned later. But, you know, the interactions that I had, you know, I had a lot of good friends, a lot of good discussions, a lot of philosophical discussions. I definitely worked through the entire gamut of, political alignments, you know, from like a kind of a hardline conservative all the way to like, you know, ultra liberal to kind of anarchistic, like maybe we should just not have a centralized government. That kind of seems like it's been doing a lot of bad stuff. You know, but all in the way, you know, the fact that I always talked to other people and at least, you know, treated them with like, you know, a baseline of respect and tried to understand them. You know, mm-hmm. that was like the one thing that my mom really instilled in me was just listening to other people. You know, like you just don't treat people like dirt. Like some people deserve it. And like you learn that and that's okay, I think. But, you know, you don't just take strangers, you know, at like negative value. Like, you know, they're a different person and they're in their own place. And, you know, I definitely learned a lot from just talking and listening to other people and trying to understand why they thought the things they thought and why they were going about the things they were going about. You know, because I always found other people's stories fascinating because I always think mine's boring. So I would ask them, like, what, you know, what do they do? What's up with you? And you know, once you get somebody telling their life story, it just kind of goes. So that was like that was something my stepdad kind of taught me was the thing you can always ask somebody about is themselves. And they'll almost always start talking. It's great.
Now, two random questions. If anybody could ask you one question about yourself, what would that question be and what is the answer?
What are you doing with your math degree?
Okay. And?
It sounds funny. You know, a lot of people, you know, I was always good at math and I enjoyed it. And I went to college and got a degree in math. And they're like, what do you do with that? You can't possibly be using all that theoretical math. And the answer is I don't use the theoretical math, but the fact that I challenged myself to understand the underlying principles and really get into, you know, it's like the whole scientist thing. Like once you learn the process of really digging through logic and how things work at a fundamental mm-hmm. level, you can apply that same sort of outlook or process to a lot of different stuff. And once it kind of like clicked with me, how some things can be really complex in appearance, but it's really driven by a few simple rules at the core and everything just kind of grows from there. You know, it kind of becomes like the analogy for kind of how I look at life. Like there, you know, there seem to be a lot of very simple things that we do, but it's all of these interactions happening together in random ways at random times. And that kind of creates like the fabric of how we live. Like, I think that's I love habits because I think habits can say a lot about a person. And somebody that actively changes their habits, like they usually start changing other habits too, because they find that changing one habit creates a better interaction down the road. And so they want to find these other ways of improving themselves. You know, and I think that you uh-huh. get a lot of people that once they're down the path of like changing things for the better, you know, whether it's an activist, whether it's a volunteer, they really get behind that because they can begin to see how the little changes they make add up to bigger changes that mean things to people.
Do you change your habits often?
I try. Not very good at some of the habits I want to change. but like my workflow habits, like I've probably changed, I don't know, probably 3 or 4 times wholesale since I started my professional career and doing all the writing and stuff. I've done really weird things. Like, you know, for a specific example, most people have, you know, if you have Windows or you have Mac OS, you have a taskbar at the bottom. Uh-huh. And that kind of shows like what's open or what programs are there. At work, like probably about 6 months ago, I switched it so it was vertical on the left-hand side, which is kind of disorienting for people that aren't used to seeing it. But for me, the reason I changed it was simply really practical, that I use my email as a to-do list. And so what I want to do is I want to get to basically daily, you know, daily deliverable 0 by the end of every day. And so basically all of the emails that I have open are things that I need to either respond to or answer completely before it's done. And basically it creates just a list on the left-hand side of my screen where I can just start going down through. And as soon as I have a free moment or I'm not in a meeting, I can just start working on the next task. And it keeps me, you know, it makes my workflow always progress to the next thing that I have to be working on or answering or planning for. And it was just a small change. And you know, I didn't like borrow it or steal it from anyone. I just kind of thought, well, what if I made this like, you know, look like a list instead of just spread across the bottom? I actually made it look like a physical list on my screen, and it made a huge difference.
Now, what has been a small change? Because you mentioned that you love the little pieces of logic that, you know, one small change leads to another small change, which leads to eventually some bigger change. What has been a thing that you have witnessed in other people's lives that they have done that sort of informed your own philosophy?
It's probably social interaction. You know, seeing when, working in a corporate environment, you know, for a major corporation, you know, we bring in individuals from the regions or we have outside hires and they're not local. So they come in to the area and the team and, it's a little intimidating going to a big city and you don't really know that many people and you're not really that involved. But seeing them like find something that they enjoy and start doing that and then hearing their stories of that, you know, they met, you know, they've got this group of guys, they're playing, you know, league dodgeball, you know, around the corner. And then like a couple of the league dodgeball guys meet every Wednesday or every Thursday for Thursday night football at like the one corner bar. And then from there, it's like, oh, well, they're planning a skiing trip. I think I'm going to go to that. And just when somebody takes that first step to finding, you know, someplace that they want to be at and they start going down that step, they, you know, it starts to just kind of like materialize before them. Like they go from not even really being sure who they should be talking to or like what they want to do other than like they want to get into work every day to coming to work and being excited about whatever trip they have coming up this weekend and they're planning all these things and just that germination of creating like a new social circle in an area from kind of scratch is always a really cool process to watch unfold.
Gotcha. No, that kind of ties into the other random question I was going to ask you. I recently went to DC. We recently hung out and had some fun at a coffee shop and I tried I was using the Metro for the first time. And I had this thought and I had this DC experience and I want you to kind of you to inform it a little bit for me. So I was on the Metro, we were heading to the airport and the Metro was pretty crowded. I mean, there was a good, you know, 10 people within, you know, the 10 feet around me or whatever. And I noticed that nobody was talking to each other or even looking at each other. And I thought that was kind of odd. For people to be so proximate, but to be so disconnected.
You know, that's kind of like the classic big city thing. But what makes DC, I think, you know, it's probably most similar to like New York, is that all of the social classes use the Metro. So whether you're somebody who's like, you know, a senior level contractor at Booz Allen Hamilton, you know, making, you know, six or seven digits, maybe, you're going to use the same Metro and the same car that somebody who's, you know, living food stamp to food stamp is. And so not only is there always that, you know, I don't talk to strangers and, you know, just kind of like give me my personal space in this very crowded commuter kind of area. But then there's also like, I don't want to talk to somebody or, you know, that social gap between different, you know, different social strati. However you want to call it, you know, if you do people watching, it's really fascinating, like how like college students or like different groups of people, they either stick together as a group and they just don't acknowledge anyone else, but they're all talking to each other, or they just do like the abject silence. Like that is the typical Metro experience. It's just everybody's quiet, looking away, and if there's noise, it probably means there's trouble.
Now, with someone as social as you were. And as kind of open and you were willing to talk to strangers and all that stuff. How did you feel about that when you first moved to DC about that now? I mean,
you know, talking to strangers is one thing. Like, I am more introverted than extroverted. Like I work at being, you know, social and outgoing. But I'm totally down for just like working with my music on by myself, not being disturbed by another human for hours on end. Like that to me is the ideal way to get work done. You're not interrupting my ability to complete this task. So for me, like I find the Metro fine. Like I enjoy looking at other people and not having to necessarily engage them all the time. But that doesn't mean there aren't times that does happen. And like the one thing that always brings people together are sporting events. You know, like if you're a fellow sports fan, that bridges any social gap because like you now have something in common that's universal and part of like what you do. Like you can always have a sports fan buddy. And so like I'll go to like Washington Capitals games and my wife's a Caps fan. I'm married into a Caps family. They're not my team, but I love hockey enough. Like I don't care. So I'll just go to the game, go to as many games as I can. It's great. So like talking to like the other hockey fans like into the game or around the arena, the Verizon Center or like on the way back out, you know, that's kind of like a really cool time because like you hear stories like the, you know, when you see somebody wearing like a really old jersey and they've got like a cap with like a bunch of pins on it, their story of like following the team over their, you know, over like two or three decades, you know, is always awesome. Like hearing them talk about like the time they first remember going to a Caps game, that's always a really good story. You know, because people usually, if they're wearing all the Caps gear, probably means that they enjoy the games, and so their first story is always like that magical moment of like, wow, like I really got into this, or like the first moment that they realized they were really behind the Caps. You know, when they got lost like a game six, when Olaf Kolzig just collapsed in one game and just didn't like deliver the goaltending they needed. You know, like the story of like when they got into it. You know, that's a really cool moment that they'll share.
And I have a lot of Canadian listeners. Who's your team?
Calgary Flames.
Okay.
Let's go. Let's go Flames. They unfortunately, I went to the Flames for the 2013-2014 season. For anyone listening deep into the future, the Flames visited the Caps for the Capitals home opener and were roundly spanking them through most of the game, and then just like gave up the ghost, and the Caps won in a overtime shootout where Ovechkin had the winning shootout shot. You know, of course, like some sort of magical storytelling rigging. But of course, when the Capitals visited the Flames the other day, they were roundly spanked as they should have been. So I will wear I have a Washington Capitals jersey, but it's 00 Slapshot. It's the mascot jersey, so okay. That's what I'll wear to the Caps games. But whenever the Flames are in town, I wear the Flames jersey for sure.
No, you don't seem, I mean, you don't have the background of a sports fan. Like you don't sound like you were into it in high school or,
nope.
where did that come from?
College, just buddies that were into sports and teams. And so they asked me, what team do you fall on? Like shrug. And of course, like there's nothing more annoying to a sports team, sports fan. The only thing more annoying to a sports fan than a fan of their rival is somebody who isn't even a fan at all. Cause it's like, I don't understand why you don't have this mindless obsession and scream obscenities at your TV all day every Sunday. you need to do this because this is the healthy thing to do. And I'm like, are you sure? Because that's not what I see, Mister, who broke his wrist last weekend when the Pittsburgh Steelers lost. Actual story, actual guy broke his actual wrist in the dorm, slamming his hand into a coffee table when the Steelers lost.
I had a friend who that's
a true story.
Yeah, I had a friend who broke his hand and the door at work when the Jayhawks got knocked out of March 2 years ago. Yeah, it was 2 years ago.
And your buddy is a high roller for sure.
Oh, I understand. Basketball?
Yeah. So for me, like I had both the luxury and idiocy of just picking my teams, which actually sounds, It's worse than it sounds, because when you don't know about sports and you don't have a history, you have a tendency to not necessarily weigh information or have all the information to make a good decision. So I'm like, I could like the, you know, maybe I follow the Steelers because I'm like a PA guy. The Steelers are kind of like the, you know, the local Pennsylvania team. They're not all like, you know, crazy like the Eagles. Mm-hmm. Philadelphia is awful. But I'm like, no, like my uncle kind of like the Browns and, you know, like they're against the Steelers. I'll just root for the Browns because like they're like the Steeler rivals. And yeah, that was a terrible, terrible mistake that I cannot undo. No matter how much I might want to, I'm still nominally follow the Browns and enjoy when they win. But I picked a lot of teams just for funsies. Like I picked the Milwaukee Brewers for baseball because that's what I do when I go to baseball games. I drink.
Oh, makes sense.
Yeah, you know, I'm just like, well, that's the team that does that. So, okay. I got into hockey the season the Flames went all the way to the finals and lost to Tampa. So I had the pleasure of watching like the run up, like the last 2 weeks, the run up to the playoffs. And I was looking at, you know, half the league plays in the playoffs. So I got to see like basically, you know, half the teams playing, you know, good hockey. And of all the styles that kind of stood out to me, you know, the kind of like the very classical, you know, physically controlling the puck, grinding it out, good defense, a lot of checking, a lot of physicality, fighting. You know, that was kind of the archetypical hockey team that I always had in my mind, and Calgary just seemed to live up to that. So I just like started following them. Whenever we did like street hockey with like my buddies, I was always the goalie, and I really thought Kiprusoff. I mean, he was an excellent goaltender. Definitely followed him. Really sad to see him retire, but because he's on my jersey, so it's awkward now. But just, you know, like they had a great goaltender that I really, really, you know, admired from a technical standpoint, and I felt was, you know, ahead above most other tenders in the league. They had a Ginla who I thought was a really good talent. He picked a fight with, I forget his name, but it was basically the enforcer on the opposing team. And I'm trying to remember, it was in the playoffs. It may have been somebody on the Red Wings. I'm trying to remember if they played in that series. Because I wasn't, you know, I wasn't a hardcore fan, so it wasn't all, like, burned in my mind at the time. But, you know, basically, Ginla picked a fight with the enforcer in the playoffs and just, like, dropped him. Just, like, totally dominated him. And Ginla's not a big guy, right? You know, if, like, you know, like, he's kind of small. So, like, watching him just, like, take this guy out and just, like, rock the crowd and just, like, drive home that, like, you know, you're going nowhere in this series. Yeah, like, that just kind of, like, was what hooked me and drew me in.
Sweet. And does sports ever, like, inform how you approach Magic?
It helps explain some of the fanaticism, like, why people, like, you know, like, the whole Tiger Woods phenomenon, like, when Tiger Woods was, like, the biggest thing, like, you know, like, I get that Tiger Woods was really good, but I didn't get, like, the sense from him, like, he was, like, somebody I should, like, really, like, admire and follow and find every move and, like, the whole, like, the TMZ, like, these are people that we're just going to, like, really zoom in and follow. So, like, in Magic, right, they're these superstars that just people really zoom in and pay a lot of attention to and follow, and they're like, well, how does LSV do it, or how does Chapin do it, or how does Finkel, you know, how does Brian shuffle his cards? I want to shuffle cards like Brian Kipling. It's like, no, like, start 10 years ago and keep practicing, and maybe you'll get good enough.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it helps put some understanding behind that. Like, I can see how somebody who really loves the game, admires the competitiveness, finds somebody that kind of they can relate to personally, whatever's inside of them that draws them to that individual or that star or that team, and they just kind of like go gung-ho all behind that. I used to really look down on that as kind of idiotic, and to be honest, I still kind of find it a little annoying from time to time, but I have a much better understanding of that, you know, that passion, when you connect to it, like, it just feels really, really good get into it.
So, yeah, he's my guy. Yeah. He's my guy.
Like, yeah, and it's just like, you know, when you watch him play Cube or, like, talk something fun, or, like, you adore their puns, and it's just like, you know, that whole amplified, like, this is, like, somebody, like, not necessarily I aspire to be, but maybe, like, inspires me to be like or to be better. And I think that latching onto that kind of ideal to work towards, or, like, somebody to move towards or be more like, I think is really appealing for a lot of people. And I get it now.
Who are your guys?
I kind of like to shop around. I kind of change my mind a lot. Like, I like to, not necessarily fair weather, but as I learn more, because when you just read the articles and you see the videos somebody produces, it's not quite the same as, like, hearing other people talk about them, or like, you know, like listening to Brian David Marshall talk about the history of, you know, Sam Black or LSV, and, like, kind of like how they evolved and became player, because these players aren't static. And I think that's something a lot of people, like, apply to, like, movie stars. They just assume, you know, this person is like this, and that's it. But they're people, too, and they evolve just like you, and they change over time, and they learn, and they grow from their experiences. And, you know, so, like, I really admire players like Shuhei Nakamura.
Okay.
And
he's a Japanese pro.
Yeah. Just somebody who's traveled the globe, loves playing to play. And he was, you know, kind of one of the first players where, when I hear the coverage guys talk about them, when I hear other pros talk about him, and just, you know, that his love for the game is what carries him. You know, it's not purely, you know, obviously he loves to win and he wants to win, because otherwise he wouldn't do it. But he also just sincerely loves the game so much that he loves the idea, loves the ability to travel and engage the world playing. And that's what he wants to do. He just wants to play Magic.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of, like, that really crystalline, you know, really distilled, pure, unadulterated love for Magic. I think that's what I connect to. Like, that's really awesome. Like, that you love it so much that that's what you want to do. I enjoy watching players like, Sam Black, Martin Yuza, guys that play a lot of Magic, travel to a lot of events, and kind of have different technical standpoints. Like, Martin is extremely good at Limited. Have a lot of respect for him. I really enjoy his articles and kind of how he approaches the Limited aspect of the game. From a technical standpoint, I really admire Sam Black and his ability to design decks, develop decks, tune them, to take a deck that people aren't necessarily expecting and do well with it, to come from a different angle and maximize something that hasn't been maximized before. You know, not quite the Conley Woods off-the-wall brew, but, Sam Black really loves his, Black-Red Sacrifice Zombies deck. Mm-hmm. You know, he played it in Legacy, and, I think he top 16 to Legacy GP with it, if I'm recalling correctly. So, that type of skill, combination of willingness to walk to his own drum and deliver on that, still be impressively good in winning, that I find is really admirable, really cool.
Now, if somebody were to tell you, Adam Staborski, you're my guy, how would you respond to that?
Probably shrug and say, sweet, cool. not sure why, but okay. I don't get a lot of you're my hero emails. I don't know. Maybe it's just because I project I'm not anybody's hero. I'm just really an everyman. I'm clearly not winning any PTQs or going to the Pro Tour anytime soon. I'm clearly not super competitive. I clearly don't have best in class deck building skills or the ability to break Commander. Even though I've been playing it forever, it feels for me, I just feel like the everyman. And if somebody looks up to me, that's awesome, and I hope I can live up to and inspire them to grow and be cool and do awesome stuff. But I don't position myself to be like a superstar, I feel like. So, it always kind of I think I've signed one playmat and two cards over the past 3 years. Which sounds about right for being a writer.
Okay.
It's cool, but it's not something that happens.
Did you ever want to be that level? Did you ever want to play high level competitive Magic?
Yeah, I kind of had a little bit of a bug. I tried to get into Legacy a little bit. I was really reading up on things. I had a junk deck put together, and I was playtesting it and kind of knew what it was. That was when junk was a deck in Legacy. It hasn't been for years, so you can kind of put the math together on how long ago this was. I don't know if it's just, my ego's too fragile, which is probably part of it, but also it's just I don't enjoy myself as much. I don't look forward to defeating my opponent. I look forward to them enjoying a game with me. And obviously that's kind of antithetical, not necessarily antithetical, but it's often the opposite of what the experience is in a competitive environment. When you're playing for, I've had rough games. It's just a pre-release, four round pre-release, and we're both 3-0. And it's this other person is just taking it very, very seriously, very intense. They'd really like to win those extra packs, and the way the prize structure works, if we draw, we end up missing out on a pack between us, and it's so we're incentivized to play it out anyway, and the pressure to just deliver, a win. It kind of annoys me. I'm just I'm having fun with these cards, and I don't even know what I'm doing half the time. I don't know what half your cards are. let's take a step back and put some scope on this. Literally a week from today, you can buy a booster box. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the stakes are here. And I find that the negative aspects of my personality and the negative things that I used to do a lot come out when I'm trying to be more competitive. I just kind of forget to be a little more nice, a little more relaxed when I'm too busy stressing out about how to beat my opponent.
Gotcha. Now, kind of going to the period after college, when did you rediscover Magic?
It was my first senior year of college.
Okay.
A guy in the dorm just started talking about his local card shop and how he wanted to go home and get all these cards. And I'm like, what cards are you talking about? And he was talking about the Full Metal Alchemist game or something like that. One of the dozen anime games that come out for a while and then die.
Mm-hmm.
But he was he was talking about there's a new Magic release coming out. And, just these comic book guys that just loved game started linking and talking about stuff. And that's when I got a link back to the Mothership and saw Ravnica was coming out soon, and I just kind of like went full tilt and bought a whole bunch of booster boxes online. Like before, like I didn't have the ability to buy anything cheap or volume or discount, and I didn't have any discretionary money. Uh-huh. Now I had lots of discretionary money in the internet, which is like the most dangerous combination of the world, right? You know, like, so we're not like drunk eBaying here, but this is like, wow, like I can buy a whole booster box and it's like $70. Like, that's insane. Like,
yeah,
that's so many extra packs. You know, that was like how I count it. I'm like, that's only seven pizzas. Like, I can deal with seven less pizzas this semester. And I think I ended up like negative like 300 pizzas by the end or something ridiculous. Like, did not work out well. But yeah, I just like bought booster packs and I'm like, well, what do I do with these? And so I was just like a crack fiend. I was just a cracking fiend, not an actual crack addict.
Uh-huh.
Which is a serious issue, and if you have that, you should seek help. But the, you know, I would just bust these packs, and then like then I discovered limited, and it was just like game over. Like that's what I wanted to do. I wanted the draft, or I wanted to build decks, and so I would organize as a resident assistant. I would organize, like I got to organize a Magic event once a month, and I would just have like people come in and basically get to draft or play at cost, and we would redraft the rares in wheel. So like if you won the draft, you got to pick one card, and then you had to wait until you mm-hmm. could pick the 16th card, which was extremely good at disincentivizing the excellent players in the area from coming in and hosing every week, because then they just couldn't, you know, win draft packs plus value.
Yeah.
So it helped mitigate some of the competitiveness, and a lot of players that were just kind of like new to Magic, like definitely taught some new players that monthly process actually became a club after I left. They actually had an advisor. Cool. And they were holding before you had to have events like specifically tied to a retail store. They were organizing like pre-releases on campus and stuff, which was really cool. I think they figured out a way to do it again, but there's like some hairiness where like they didn't have a store per se, so they find like a store in the area, and there's not that many dedicated Magic stores in the middle of nowhere, Pennsylvania, as it turns out. But they figured something out, I think. But that was kind of how I got back into it for a little while.
Now, during this time, you know, you're going through college, you're trying to meet girls, you're going to parties, you know, where is nerdiness in all of this? Were you kind of going through a phase where you were a little ashamed of your nerdiness, or did you experience that, or did you ever hide the fact that you were a Magic player?
No.
Okay.
I had a Monty Python movie poster on my wall. That was just kind of like, you know, like I just didn't care enough that other people thought bad of it. I just enjoyed it enough that I just kept going with it. World of Warcraft definitely helped a lot. That exploded, and I eventually got pulled into that from all of my role-playing and gaming friends. You know, visiting Azeroth for like a year or three was definitely something I think most of the people that I know have done. And I definitely went through that phase too and really enjoyed it. But it was totally the same social experience. Like I played WoW because all my buddies were playing WoW and I wanted to play with them. And we would ventrilo together and have a lot of fun. But it was the same type of, you know, we're all getting together and having fun together experience for me.
No, you mentioned that in our conversation in DC that you were a fairly competitive WoW player. How is that different from being a competitive Magic player?
I wouldn't say competitive because I didn't do PvP, strictly PvE, but I was definitely So PvP is, you know, you're literally battling other players, and so mm-hmm. like it's directly, you know, head-to-head competition against, you know, another intelligent human being, or unintelligent if you're losing. And, it definitely has its own metagame and different builds of teams. And, like, that was, like, Arena was, like, new and coming out and growing. I didn't really care for PvP that much. I liked PvE, which was highly cooperative. So, like, basically it was, like, I was playing Arch Enemy with my friends. And we were all, like, fighting the arch enemy all the time. Like that was the thing. It was like I was a tank and I wanted to maximize my ability to be effective. So like I really went just like I do with like most role playing games that I do. You know, I think I also mentioned that it was like a level grinder. Like I played Final Fantasy and stuff, of course, growing up, and Pokemon, and like I tried to honestly collect all 151 Pokemon, and there are no other there are no more Pokemon. There's only 151. That I can tell you for a fact. despite what my 3DS tells me. But, you know, like, I always wanted to, like, to have, like, the, you know, to grind it out. And so, like, I just went full depth on, like, trying to really understand and build and be the very best I could, because, like, I was, like, helping my friends. And, like, if I wasn't on my best, I felt like I was letting them down. And so it wasn't competitive in the sense, like, I'm doing better than them. It's, like, competitive in the sense that I have to do the absolute very best that I can, or I'm not living up to, like, what I can do for my friends. And that's kind of what drove it, is because they, you know, they would help me out, or they would point me to forums and we talk strategy. And, you know, that was before, you know, they kind of streamlined and simplified a lot of the process. So, like, a lot of times we'd have to, like, sit and really try to figure out what we can do, how we were going to do it, what would happen at certain moments, and be very coordinated and interactive about it. And so it was that collaboration that really kind of pushed me forward.
Okay. And then your wife, when did you meet her? And how?
My second senior year, through mutual friends. Like, you know, as you imagine, you meet a lot of a lot of things. You know, I think there might have been online dating, but I mean, I'm on a college campus. Like, if you're not meeting people on a college campus, like, you're just not talking to enough people. So just introduced through mutual friends, and at the time I had a girlfriend back at home, and
the girlfriend home.
Well, no, I just I dated a not very nice person for like 2 years. I wish I could have that time back, but it taught me a lot. So it's like, would I change it? I'm not sure. Like, it was really, really instructive for me on learning relationships.
But not very nice. How so?
It's just abusive. I should have known better. Like, literally in our first month, like, her one shtick was she just, like, would just punch me in the arm. When, you know, it was like kind of like a playful thing. But then, like, it happened so frequently, I actually was bruised, which was, like, kind of like a red flag. But when you don't know better, you just kind of, like, whatever. Uh-huh. I have a girlfriend. But, no, I had broken up with her in the summer. And then, like, a month later, I started dating this other girl back at home, who was really nice. But I don't think it was right time for her, because I was at college for, like, the second week. And she was supposed to come up, and she was like, yeah, I'm not going to come up. I'm actually going to get back together with my ex-boyfriend that I spent the entire time we were together complaining about. I'm like, oh, okay, well, that's great. So I had met my wife like the weekend before, and she thought I was cute or whatever. I'm like, oh, he has a boyfriend. So I'm supposed to be on duty that weekend. So I just go to like the RA above me, and I go, hey, here's the deal. My girlfriend broke up with me, dumped me for her ex-boyfriend that she hates. So I need to go get drunk. Can you work this weekend? And so, of course, it's like, yeah, man, you know, bro code for sure. Mm-hmm. So I went out, and that's when she found out I was single, because I was extremely hammered extremely quickly, because I didn't really care to meet her myself. I'm just like, yeah, let's have shots with everyone at multiple bars. But it was good. So her friend was actually acquainted with me, another RA. Was actually playing Magic at the time, and so got my wife to come to an event and do pictures. Now, mind you, my wife has absolutely zero interest in Lord of the Rings, Star Wars, anything fantasy, Magic, role-playing. None of that is her bag.
What is her bag?
Real Housewives?
Oh, okay.
Like, yeah,
she's a typical woman.
She's definitely into like the people watching, you know, like if somebody else is having a train wreck in motion, she is the type to sit there and watch, and she just wants to see that train wreck. She, you know, she likes to read, so she reads a lot of books, but it's like, you know, I think Jennifer Weiner and some of the authors that she likes. I have to check my Amazon account to see what she's bought. but definitely different type of books from what I read. But yeah, just, you know, also very quiet, generally speaking. So I didn't know better. So it's like, I didn't understand like what was up. Like, she came out and agreed to do pictures. Anyway, I thought she was just being nice. And she was also like better friends with, you know, my other friends. So I'm like, oh, this makes total sense. Yeah. And then I was still working back at home. Also still working with, you know, at the same restaurant my ex-girlfriend was at. So, so that was fun. But I would go home and basically work like a double on a Saturday once a month to keep up my, like I worked at Cracker Barrel and they have like star levels. And so like, I was like at the highest star, but I'd lose all of them if I didn't work every 30 days. So I'd go home once a month and work a double shift on a Saturday. And so like I'm getting ready to leave for home on a Friday, and they invite me to go back out like me to go out the next night. And I'm like, well, here's the thing. I'm only working 12 hours, you know, 4 hours away. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll make it up as soon as I can. So I ended up coming up, going home, working a double, coming all the way back up and driving and parking on the street and walking right into the bar after going home and showering first. But literally walk in at midnight. So all the drink specials are over, which is the worst. And so I ended up just paying for, like, dealer special, like, whatever the bartender would give me. So it was, like, some horrendous shot that was just, like, three, you know, like, eight different kinds of liquor, and it tasted awful. But popped me up quick. And we ended up just, like talking the whole night. Went back to her apartment and, like, watched, like, I think, like, a movie. And her roommate was, like, sleeping on the couch. So I was going to go back to my room, and I asked if she wanted to go back there. You know, again, Nothing nefarious here, folks. Everybody's pants stayed on. You know, this is conversations. This is not code for drunken one-nighters, all right? My wife is a lady, if nothing else. So we ended up going back, and I think I put on, like, When Harry Met Sally, because, like, that's, like, my favorite movie of all time. And we ended up just, like, talking until, like, almost dawn, slept, like, 3 hours, like, napped, basically, and then got up and went to, like, breakfast with everyone else. And it just kind of, like, went from there.
Cool. Now, did you pretty much wear your nerd flag on, wear your nerd heart on your sleeve?
Our first official date, I wore a Star Wars t-shirt to dinner. there was, you know, that was one of the things that I learned from kind of like previous relationships was, you know, there is absolutely zero value. In fact, it is negative EV. Yeah, you know, all you grinders out there, it is negative EV to hide, to lie, to obfuscate, to ignore, to brush away, to hang up for now anything that you enjoy doing. Like, if you are passionate about something, if it's something you enjoy, and somebody that is interested in you decides that because you enjoy that thing, you aren't somebody I'm interested in, they're not somebody you should be pursuing. Just walk away. Like,
but they're like, so honest hot. To God,
who cares?
Adam, they're so hot.
Pornhub.com, way hotter. But seriously, it's just like if you're with somebody and they don't, at the very least, acknowledge and accept that you have these things that they're not interested in, and they're okay with you being passionate about it, you know, they're probably not worth your time. Like, they're just not, you know, they're just, it's not going to end well if you don't have a relationship where you're building on just mutual respect and, like, there are these TV shows that annoy the hell out of me that my wife watches, but it's fine. I'm not watching them. You know,
no, like, you're
sometimes
too busy.
I walk in and I just see, like, a cat fight going on. Like, yeah, well, I walk in and it's like there's a cat fight going on. I'm like, wow, this seems like the most idiotic thing I've ever seen in my life. And then I can just walk away. Like, it does not affect me in any way. It doesn't actually change my view or perspective on anything. It's just somebody else's life and I can just ignore it. My wife likes to peek in and watch the train wreck. I just walk by it.
Uh-huh.
That's fine. You know, so, like, she doesn't get magic. She doesn't get the cards, but, like, she's like, that's fine that, like, you're really passionate about that. Like, that's cool. Like, cause, like, I also make time for her, you know, it's a balancing act. Like, if all I did was game and do magic, yeah, I should rightfully be catching some flack for that. But, like, there's eternal weekend and it's like 3 hour drive away and, like, everybody I know is going there just to hang out, and I'm gonna stay home and probably hang out with my daughter and then go to a Caps game with my wife, you know, because, like, that's what I need to do this weekend. Like, just make sure I put in, you know, like, it's not like I'm going to enjoy it less, it's just different. You know, I'm gonna have a lot of fun at the Caps game and I'm gonna meet up with friends and do cool stuff and do laundry and all the domestic stuff around the house, but you know, it's definitely worthwhile.
Yeah, I agree. So, Adam, you met your wife in college. You graduate. What kind of brought you to DC in your current job?
My wife.
Okay.
I was looking for a job. I went home and I worked at both Best Buy and Cracker Barrel. Kind of the very traditional, I'm out of college, neither place is going to employ me full time, so I'll just work like 29 hours at two places. So, you know, my
been
daily schedule
before.
Was get up, open Best Buy, work until like 4 p.m., go straight to Cracker Barrel, change my clothes, work until close, go home, maybe do a load of laundry and or eat and or shower, get up, start over. And so basically I was working, you know, 7 days a week, which made it, of course, retail, you know, wait staff. It makes it very difficult to try to visit a significant other or plan anything, because you don't get a lot of leave and or anything like that. But eventually her aunt worked at Geico, or still works at Geico, I should say. And basically I was able to get a referral, and after applying for like two different positions, I found a good fit in marketing.
Cool. And what is it about marketing? Because that it doesn't seem to use your math degree.
When, you know, insurance is a very competitive industry. You know, Geico has been growing for a long time, you know, basically is a modern brand success story about building a brand up, you know, after uh-huh. Hathaway bought them in the early 90s. So in terms of how do you maintain aggressive growth in a highly competitive market, it basically comes down to a lot of research and analytics. And so,
Okay. So you actually,
yeah. So,
okay. My title uses your math degree a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not always, you know, a bunch of really highfalutin, you know, academic, high end modeling, although that certainly plays a part, you know, in any national corporation, but, just a lot of, a lot of vetting, a lot of analytics, a lot of reporting, a lot of really trying to tease out what the story is, what's valuable in it, and what decisions we should be making now that we know this. And it's just doing that to a lot of different sources of information and data over and over and over. And I'm only seeing a small slice of the pie, because Geico is a huge national company. You know, we're a leader, you know, usually a leader in our category for advertising spending. So you can imagine there are a lot of people looking very closely to make sure that we're getting the most out of the dollars that we spend. And so that's kind of where guys like me come in.
Gotcha. And how
does
yeah. Now you have a child. Are you excited about passing on your interests to you have a daughter, right? Are you excited about passing on your interests to her?
I mean, we may have visited the Lego store, and I may have bought Legos for her at the Lego store last weekend. That may be a thing. you know, I'm less excited, you know, the idea of trying to make like a coffee myself. I think a lot of people fall in love with themselves and think that they're awesome and they'd love their children to be just like them. And I think that's problematic and dangerous for a lot of reasons, because your children are not you. They're a different person. And if you do your job right, they're going to grow up into probably a better person than you. That's the ideal that I'm striving for, is there are things I'm interested in. I'll share them with her. And if she ends up being interested in them, great. If she ends up having different interests or different pursuits, you know, those are the things that I'm going to be supporting her in and learning about and getting a chance to understand. So really it's going to be up to her, but I'm going to share in whatever she chooses to share in.
Yeah. Now, how are you going to also help her not fall into the trap that you fell into in high school and in your childhood of being an asshole? As you described.
Well, for starters, modeling better social interaction is a good start.
Okay.
Just being around people, seeing interaction, talking with people, yeah, that's a good start. But honestly, I think it's very easy to look at high school and say there are these uncool kids that cool, and there are these cool kids that just seem to have easy street. And I think basically all teenagers just go through awkward, you know, feeling awkward, feeling distant, struggling with learning interpersonal relationships, struggling with personal interests versus group expectations. The whole kind of span of adolescence is really constant change and growth and development. So I don't think I can hide or shield her from being presented with a conflict of society believes this or her friends believe this and she doesn't. What my mission is and what I'm going to work really hard at is to give her the tools to critically analyze that and to go, simply because a group of people or a lot of people that I know or people that I respect or admire look down on something doesn't mean that's something to be looked down on or that's something that's bad. In the same way that I should not be looking down on people for the things that they enjoy or pursue, particularly if it doesn't hurt people. If they're doing something harmful or destructive or potentially harmful or destructive, that's when we need to talk to people and we need to help our friends, you know, steer them away from behaviors that they, you know, that might not end up well, you know, binge drinking or getting a tattoo or early, you know, things like that where they haven't had where they're in a position to do some serious harm to themselves. But whether you like a book or a movie, whether you want to dress a certain way or wear certain clothes, those are things that ultimately are relatively unimportant, despite what other people might say. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I can get her to understand that and go, you know, I have a bunch of friends that say my shoes are ugly, but screw it. These are awesome shoes and I'm going to wear them, and being comfortable with that and finding the friends that are comfortable with that too. That's kind of my goal and what I hope for her to experience.
Cool. Now, as far as your work ethic, wow. Question two.
This is like question four, by the way. I've been counting. This is many more than two.
How do you determine what kind of projects you take on and what you don't? Because you are very involved with coverage and with your own website. You also have a full-time job. You are a father and a husband. Why do you work that hard? Like, why magic? Why not just kind of relax?
I mean, I do a lot of relaxing. I mean, to be fair, writing is not necessarily a physically intensive activity where I am straining my body and honing it to be a athletic fitness or physique. So neither is magic, for that matter. It's not a forever thing. Like, I know 20 years from now, there's no way I could sustain this level of effort. Mm-hmm. You know, 30 years from now, I'm not going to be able to sustain this. But right now, where I am and the opportunities that have ahead for me and the knowledge and experience that I can get from being responsible to do, you know, self-edited contracting gigs on the fly for a major gaming company, to be responsible enough to, the skills that I picked up there helped me when I, you know, I helped edit a marketing business plan next year for Geico. And basically I coordinated with all the management team and got basically content from them and organized it and made sure it was formatted consistently. And as you imagine, that starts to sound very familiar to the thing I'm doing, you know? And so I think that that's the biggest thing that people overlook is that, you know, if you really enjoy watching football and that's what you want to do on Sunday, that's great. What I really enjoy is stretching my mind in a different way. Like, I really get into reading, trying to catch up on content, reading articles. I'm a really big reader of like The Verge, Polygon, kind of these mix of contemporary, but also a lot of long form research type article websites. The Atlantic is a great example of a website that are in, you know, those are the things that I really enjoy to do on a Sunday morning. And I'm looking at them to understand what's good content. What are people reading? Why do people read things? And it's just, you know, I'm constantly, the things that I enjoy happen to be also things that are good to learn and are skills that I'm growing. And for now, you know, I'm really interested in growing and learning skills and broadening my experience so I can become, you know, a better leader or become a, you know, a good supervisor or manager someday and help the next wave come along. And when they're ready to learn and grow and expand, I have places to show them and places that I can point them to and experience that I can pass down to them, because there's going to come a point where I can't keep up and keep learning new things at the pace that I'm doing it now, because I really want to go and watch my daughter play in some game or do a play, or I've got to go pick her up and take her to the doctor, mm-hmm. you know? So now I have the opportunity and the luxury of having that additional time. And I feel like if I don't do something with it, you know, I'm wasting it, and that's on me.
Makes sense. And why magic? I'll leave it with it. I'll leave you with this last question.
it's the best game on the planet. It's the best game ever. It's the best game in history. You know, I really enjoy it. I've made a lot of friends through Magic. I had a lot of good experiences around Magic cards. And I guess kind of in the words of Liam Neeson, I have developed a very specific set of skills that make me a nightmare for people like you.
And I'm going to cheat. Have you ever thought about quitting?
Like quitting Magic, or like quitting doing all the work and everything? Those seem like two different questions.
yes.
I think on the occasions that I tilt, sometimes I feel like if I didn't play Magic, I would never tilt. which is probably untrue because I tilt in traffic and I tilt on airline delays and I tilt when my laptop cuts to a blue screen and does a memory dump in the middle of covering quarterfinals at an event. True story. So I don't think I would get rid of the stress, but you know, there are times where there's just a confluence of events that work, you know, work against each other. You know, contacting deadline bleeds into gathering magic deadline bleeds into world of, you know, hey, I've got to stay late at the office and take care of some business. The idea, I think, of being able to walk away from something is often appealing. It's just like, let it go, it's done, and don't have to worry about it. But then what do I do with all that time? Like, I would just, you know, I would just go in a circle. And I'd just be chasing my tail. Like, I'd walk away from Magic, but then I'd probably just get right back into WoW and really try to catch up on the PvE content and just, like, you know, there'd be something else that I would end up dedicating myself to and end up becoming really engaged with. You know, so it's you know, whether it's Magic or something else, I would still be in that constant flux of finding the next thing that I want to be working on or diving into the next thing that I'm really passionate about. And so, thankfully, Magic is just awesome enough that I don't have to look for anything else. It's more than good enough on its own. And there's way more to it than I can ever really get to. And I find both of those fascinating.
All right, Adam. So if somebody wanted to check out your work, where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter as the_Stybs, STYBS. I usually share a lot of cool stuff there. I like cool stuff. I'm on Gathering Magic as the content manager, of course, so you'll see news articles, posts. I'll put all my Pauper Cube updates there, so if you're really into cubing and you want to see my Pauper Cube, that's where you'll find that information. So that goes up quarterly, you know, when the set's released. I'm on Daily MTG every Thursday, and if you check out the event coverage history, you'll find me popping up throughout 2013 and beyond at some of the events.
Cool. Well, Adam, thank you very much.
Thank you. On the couch in the blue room with everyone stoned and talking at
once. No thought to where they've been. Welcome back, everybody. My name is Matt Mendoza, and once again, you've been listening to Across the Table 28 and my interview with Adam Staborski. If you're interested in following the cast on Twitter or Facebook, you can do so. The Twitter handle for the cast is @AcrossTheCast. And you can search for Across the Table Podcast on Facebook. As well, you can send me any feedback on Twitter @MattMendoza or via email @AcrossTheTablePod@gmail.com. As well, you can find the cast on iTunes. Just search for Across the Table and Man Enterprise. And tell your friends about the show, won't you? Next week, we've got a special episode live from Kansas City. I won't spoil your guest. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you have a great day. Never heard, never.